This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
You're listening to The West Wing Weekly. My name is Hrishikesh Hirway.
And my name is Joshua Molina.
Today, we're talking about Episode 7 of Season 2. It's called The Portland Trip.
It first aired on November 15th, 2000. The teleplay is by Aaron Sorkin. The story by Paul Redford. The direction by Paris Barkley. Paris is a very, very talented guy who also directed the I See You episode from Scandal Season 5.
He won a DGA award for directing for this episode.
Nice.
Here's the synopsis from TV Guide. The president is taking a red eye to Portland, Oregon to deliver an education address, and Sam must go with him because he can't get the speech right. Toby must also go to help Sam, and CJ has to go too because she's being punished for making disparaging remarks about the president's alma mater, Notre Dame. Back at the White House, Josh spars with a gay Republican congressman over a bill on homosexual marriage, and Leo monitors a minor crisis in the Persian Gulf involving an oil tanker.
I like the phrase, the president is taking a red eye as if he's flying commercial. You know what? Just book me on the red eye.
And they make a nice plot point about
the scheduling of the flight.
Yeah. I really like this part of the episode when the president says,
you know why late flights are good? Because we cease to be earthbound and burdened with practicality. Ask the impertinent question. Talk about the idea that nobody has thought about yet. Put it a different way. Be poets.
I figured you would.
Of course, it's not actually the reason why, but wouldn't it be great if it were?
That's true. The moment's a little bit breathlessly romantic for me, but I kind of like it.
That moment or this episode in general?
Maybe this episode in general. No, there's a certain... I might be having West Wing fatigue.
Really?
Yeah. I'm not quitting the podcast or anything. I still love the show, but... as I watched it, I thought, maybe I'm watching too much West Wing, and I should be caught up in the breathless romanticism of certain parts of this episode, and I'm not because I'm watching the show too much.
Watching the show too much should mean that you are being uplifted and inspired, but that's not happening?
No, I liked this episode. I guess maybe it's like a West Wing junkie thing, and I'm not getting the hits that I need. My palate feels cleansed over the last few episodes. I'm ready for something major to happen. I want a little more meat.
Right. This is another one that's a contained, singular episode.
Yes, and I do tend to like them, but I feel like we've maybe had three in a row, and I'm ready for the roof to fall in.
I love this episode.
Well, I'm open. I feel like looking at whatever, the 25 or 26 episodes we've done of this so far, the net result is I drag you down slightly. So I'm ready to be uplifted.
Okay.
By you in this episode. I'm ready to leave our discussion with a greater appreciation. Although, again, I enjoyed this episode well enough.
Maybe you might say that I am like the president and I want to be inspired and I want to be taken off the ground and you're like Leo or Toby and you have to ground me at the end.
That is true. So. And now I understand why we're recording this at midnight. And then maybe that'll work.
Exactly.
At your request.
Right. Because night podcasts, yeah. Could you think of anything
and
more
we are just
poetic?
To set the scene, we are outside. We're in a marsh.
I was going to say, we're on a plane.
Oh, that's right. I forgot. We are on a plane in a marsh.
High above the marshes of South Bend, Indiana.
Yeah. We are, though, in the same room for a change.
That's true.
We've done that once before.
Well, we've been in the same room many times before, but usually with some interloper.
That is true. I mean, when we're doing right, just a mano recap, we've only done that once before. Usually we're in our own homes.
Recording in mono.
Nice. Mano a mano. And occasionally with our shirts off. But here we are in the same room.
Fully clothed.
As far as people know. Okay, let's get back to the episode.
Here's a question for you.
The answer is no.
I'm going to state the question now in a way that the answer could be no. Is there any good reason why Leo has to drive all the way out to the plane to tell the president about the tanker?
I think he wants to get his little football zets in live.
And again, it wouldn't work. Wouldn't work over the phone.
No, I don't think so. I think he wanted to be there. It's all about facial mano a mano, I like to say. Mm.
He comes out in the car onto the tarmac, gets out, and he says, "We have the situation with the tanker." Gets back in the car and he drives off.
If only the phone had been invented, I would have. Yeah, that's a good point. Well, yeah. I used to love this episode, and now you've ruined it for me.
Well, I do have some issues with this episode, and not minor ones, but I still love it. And it starts pretty early on. The dynamic between Josh and Donna in this episode is a little dark for me.
Well, yeah, I wrote down horrible what Josh says to Donna.
You actually have no sense about these things. You have no vibe. You have terrible taste in men. And your desire to be coupled up will always and forever drown out any small sense of self or self-worth that you may have.
And I think there's a moment where you see Janelle Maloney as Donna decide not to let that land with as much weight as it might have.
Yeah.
Because that could have been like a f*** you moment.
Yeah. You know, I think she initially kind of tees him up to have a reaction when she says, "I have a good sense for this." And then he takes the bait and you see she smiles in a way that's like, "Ha ha, I got you." And I think it's, you know, in the first grader teasing way of their dynamic, she's laying a trap so he can turn around and say, "Here's some evidence that shows I actually really like you." But then he turns around and he's like, "I'm going to tease you back." But then, yeah, he drops this whopper of a line that is way too mean. It's terribly mean.
You're right.
And the thing that I think is the harshest part about it is I think he believes it.
Yeah, it feels like he means it.
And yeah, she chooses to let it not hurt so much, but there's no way that she doesn't hear that.
It had to have landed.
Yeah. And that broke my heart, not just for the fact that he was being such a dick, but that she smiles and shrugs it off. And apparently her feelings for him have not changed, even in the wake of a line like that. The things that a girl will forgive a guy for, I mean, I guess it goes both ways, but just the fact that that's forgivable, I don't know, that was too harsh. And it continues throughout this episode.
That is true. It gets maybe a little bit lighter later. That's the real one that really lands with the thud.
I think, right.
I want to just yell, "Get out."
Yeah.
Get out. Don't get into, if you're thinking about it for real, don't get into a relationship with this guy. That's not the kind of thing you say to someone you care deeply about.
And he heard you, and now he's in the new movie, Get Out.
Boom.
I thought that both Josh and Aaron mistreated Donna in this episode. Because it's not just in this exchange. I feel like Donna has done a disservice throughout the whole thing. She's really kind of reduced to this quote. What Josh says, "Your desire to be coupled up will drown out any small sense of self or self-worth." They kind of mirror that throughout the whole episode. And she ends up, apart from like one sentence that she exchanges with Ainsley about full faith and credit, she's basically a walking failure of a Bechdel test the whole episode. The whole time she's just like talking about guys. And she's talking about, like, there's one line that really bothered me where she says,
"I play the flute. In high school, I was the best in my row. So I ask myself, if I'd pursued the flute professionally, would I be meeting interesting men?" And the answer comes back to me, probably not.
For me, the nadir takes place in the steam pipe distribution venue.
Right.
When she comes in and she's basically, her whole riff is, "Do we look alike?"
Yeah.
"And do you think you want to dye your hair?" I thought, oh, is that who Donna is?
Yeah, that's why I think that she is better than that. And I felt like she was badly treated in this episode. Ainsley is not badly treated, and she gets to sort of play off of that and show, you know, like,
"I played the trombone.
Did you meet interesting men?"
"Yeah."
And then immediately Donna says,
"Is it a hard instrument to learn if I took it out now?"
Talk to me about the...
I mean, it's just, it's a little bit pathetic. And I don't want to feel that way about Donna, that she's pathetic in any way.
Yeah, I had a similar experience watching it.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't want Donna to be that person.
The power dynamic between her and Josh, sure, she's his assistant, but clearly their relationship is deeper than that and more complicated than that. But here, it really felt like the power dynamics were icky.
Well, maybe we're seeing how raw and vulnerable she was made by that early comment, and maybe she's reduced to her not best self.
Yeah.
And it lands more palpably than we initially thought.
A big part of this episode is this confrontation that Josh has with Congressman Skinner. And Congressman Skinner is there to talk about the Marriage Recognition Act. And it's revealed early on that, you know, this is their version of DOMA that's supposed to keep same-sex marriage off the books. But he's there as a representative of the Republican Party against this bill. even though he is gay.
Interesting, I thought dramatically that it is revealed so early on in the episode. I don't know whether I like that or not, but I just think if I were writing it, it would be more of a,
save it to the end?
Or later, certainly. Yeah. It was interesting to front load it with that information rather than spring it on us in a more, I mean, maybe that's just atypical writing, which is better than your average writing, saying I don't have to toss this out like an aha moment or a gimmick. It's just, this is going to be part of the conversation, the fact of the situation.
I would agree with that. I kept thinking, this is an interesting position. It's an unintuitive one. And the reason why I think it is interesting to reveal it early is because it's so surprising that you would have gay Republican congresspeople to begin with, at least on the surface, it seems like it. But I talked to former Congressman Steven Gunderson, who was the very first openly gay Republican congressman, about his take on this issue and what it was like to be in that position.
And when was he in Congress?
Congressman Steve Gunderson was in office from 1981 to 1997. Hmm. He was outed in 1994.
Oh, interesting. Against his will.
Not by his own doing.
Interesting. And he was in office in 1996 when DOMA passed.
Yes. The difference is that he stood up against it.
Unlike our West Wing congressman.
Yeah. But there's the log cabin Republicans, or a group of Republicans who are gay and stand with the Republican Party, despite the terrible homophobia and just hate speech, really, that the party regularly unleashes. And it made me think that log cabin Republicans are kind of like Donna, and the Republican Party is kind of like Josh, that they will just say some awful things, and no matter what, these guys just won't quit them. To bring him.
Oh, look at what you. There's so many references going on now. I just have to nod my head. But he voted against DOMA.
Exactly. Yeah. Congressman Gunderson did. And let's drop in that call now.
Let's.
Call me Steve.
All right. Thanks so much, Steve, for talking to me. I was wondering if you could just give me really quickly a little background on yourself and your time in Congress.
Sure. First of all, I spent a total of 22 years in elective office, 6 in the state legislature, and then 16 years in the U.S. Congress. So it was a long stint of public policy engagement, and it was a very different era than we have today.
And in this episode of The West Wing, there's a character named Matt Skinner, who is a Republican congressman who is defending an act that's essentially the West Wing's version of the Defense of Marriage Act. In the show, it's called the Marriage Recognition Act. And one of the characters in the show confronts him by asking him how he could be a gay person and also be a member of the Republican Party. I was wondering if you were ever confronted with a question like that.
Oh, probably 1,000 times.
And what would your answer be?
Well, my answer is, first of all, I am a Lincoln Republican. I call that and define that as someone who believes in a strong market-oriented regulatory economy, a pro-growth economy. I believe strongly that the private sector has to grow in order for all citizens to improve their lot and their standing in American society. I'm certainly what you would call a national security or foreign policy Republican. I believe in a strong national defense. I believe in a strong role for America globally. And so when you look at all of this, you would find that on the economic issues, on the military foreign policy issues, on the regulatory issues, on the local control perspective, I'm a Republican. The one place where I disagreed with the Republican Party at the time in which I served was on some of the social issues. And a very good example of that was equal opportunity for everyone, including, should I say, the gay, lesbian, transgender issues, and certainly marriage equality, on whether that A should be a state issue or B, it should be recognized in federal law as one which treats everybody the same.
It has to be hard for any member of any party enacting legislation when legislation is so widely encompassing to feel like they can stand with their party on every single issue. I mean, I can't imagine that there's anybody who feels like they agree with their party on everything.
If they agree with their party on everything, they probably have little or no independent thought. And to be a blank check for party rhetoric, party leadership, party policy. Anything over the span of, in my case, 22 years of public life would suggest that I don't have the ability or the desire to independently consider what I think is best for my constituents and my country.
Did you ever have trouble convincing other gay people that they should belong to the Republican Party? Did you ever try and make that argument even?
I can make a solid argument for them on ways outside of the specific policy related to gays. I mean, such as Defense of Marriage Act, such as non-discrimination, et cetera. Because a lot of them say, look, we want and need a strong federal policy in this area. And I understand and respect that. I would suggest to you that it is the combination of legislative policy becoming law, certainly the courts and their interpretation, and economics that gives them the opportunity to grow and survive and succeed as an individual or as a partnership.
Steve, thank you so much for talking to me about this. It's really great to get your perspective.
Happy to help.
I want to say that I respect the idea that you don't have to be a single issue politician or a single issue voter or anything like that, that you can be gay and you can also be for small government and all these other tenets that the Republican Party stands for.
Fiscal conservatism.
Strong defense, whatever you want to say. But there is something so intrinsically messed up about the idea that like part of your identity is an anathema. It feels a little bit like Donna here, where it's like, can you just, you know, it feels like their inability to break away is saying something about their sense of self-worth.
Well, I think there's certainly some truth to that. I mean, I would say in the congressman's, or fictional congressman's defense, he makes the argument towards the end that he's taking a change from within approach.
Mm-hmm.
And although he's, what is the West Wing's version of DOMA?
The Marriage Recognition Act.
Marriage Recognition Act, he is going to vote for, but he makes the argument to Josh in response to the how can you possibly be part of this party that he is looking to make a change from within. So he at least has a, whether you buy it or not, an argument that in the grander scheme, he is a Republican policy-wise, and as a gay Republican, he can only evoke change in their platform or their policies by being a Republican.
What do you think about the idea that these two plots are supposed to be parallel?
Are meant to be?
Yeah.
I think you are maybe drawing interesting, I think you're having an interesting response that maybe was not intended, but that makes it good art if it's meaty and fertile to be explored, whether or not the author or authors had that intention.
Yeah.
It's also an interesting, the whole, so DOMA passed in 1996 with a veto-proof majority, but President Clinton signed it.
Right.
And there is, it's been brought up again recently with Hillary Clinton, and there have been some perhaps partially revisionist looks back on why he signed it. I think Hillary Clinton stated in an interview, I think with Rachel Maddow, that President Bill Clinton saw signing the act as a stopgap measure against a greater movement to pass a constitutional amendment. But it doesn't, I think, hold up to close scrutiny.
Yeah, it's
and
like
so what? I think we get an interesting, I think we're getting Aaron's take on what he would prefer to see the president do. In other words, when President Bartlett is considering whether or not to sign this thing, it's Aaron's revision of the Bill Clinton years.
Right. Although even then, President Bartlett says,
in the end,
yeah, I'm sure the gay community can't wait to thank me because he sticks it in a drawer, only to have to pull the bill out in January and sign it then.
Will it be revisited on the West Wing?
No.
No. Would have been interesting, actually, to see President Bartlett put to it and see what the final response would be.
Yeah, symbolic gestures, not so great when there are real non-symbolic repercussions.
Indeed. One of the nice things that I was thinking as I watched this, though, is, you know, made me think back the Clinton years and DOMA, but it was also nice to watch it from 2016, knowing that in 2013, the Supreme Court would find DOMA unconstitutional, and that in 2015, the Supreme Court would guarantee the right for same-sex marriage in all 50 states. I mean, it's one of those nice, I guess, fairly rare moments when you watch the show and you know, at least from my point of view, the happy ending that has happened.
Right.
A lot of the times we watch something and we know there's been some progress, or maybe there's been no progress, and you can't believe how on point Aaron was way back when, raising an issue that's still burning. It's nice to be able to see, oh, I know the exact progress that was made in this arena.
And not just legislatively, because they even bring up the fact that the congressman says 60% of Americans oppose gay marriage. And Josh has to bring up the fact that, you know, public opinion can be wrong and that you can legislate ahead of public opinion. 60% of Americans oppose gay marriage, whereas now somewhere between 53 and 60% of Americans now support same-sex marriage.
That's right. So you're right. Social change has been extreme, or significant, I should say. And actually, as much as I hate to bring it up again, that also speaks to when we talked about the Jenna Jacobs scene, just the, you were urging me to view the importance of the scene in the time in which it came out. And those were very different times.
Yeah. There's a lot of product placement in this episode,
Especially
in the beverage arena.
Yes. Well, that's funny. I was thinking Aaron does love semi-obscure beverages. He likes his Yoo-Hoo, and he likes his Fresca.
Mm-hmm. And his Dewars on the Rocks.
Mm. Is that from the pilot?
From the pilot and a few other times on the show.
Interesting. I wonder if he has cases and cases of Dewars that have been sent to him. Or maybe the Ice Cube people have just constantly sent him rocks. Bags and bags of them from the year 2000.
This episode has Fresca, has Canada Dry. We got a shot of a Canada Dry can of ginger ale. Petrus wine.
Mm.
Leo recommends it.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack Daniels, which is what Toby orders. Plus, there's also Max Mara gets a shout out from CJ. She says she's wearing Max Mara, and that's why she shouldn't put on the Notre Dame cap.
Now you have me intrigued. I wonder whether, are you positing that there were actual product placement deals in place? Because that, it does happen.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought it was just there for specificity.
I mean, I'll tell you, the next time you hear an actor on a late night talk show saying, oh, I had the worst headache and I took two Advil and then I was able to go back to the set, they're getting paid for that.
Right.
That's a $40,000 mention right there. So it's entirely possible that there was some real product placement.
I mean, they've got Air Force One that clearly were burning up budget in the production values for this episode. So maybe. But I thought it was a nice detail that CJ is wearing Max Mara, contrasted with Donna, who can't afford to keep the dress that she's bought. I was like, oh, this is the difference between, well, not even the difference between the press secretary and the assistant to the deputy chief of staff. It's really, here's a woman who used to get paid six figures to be a Hollywood publicist, who's much more likely to have a $2,000 Max Mara piece than
this is true.
Anybody who's really on the government payroll.
You know, Josh, it's just occurring to me now, he had a chance in that last moment, that the kind of their little, I guess, supposedly happy resolution is he's...
You look really great in that dress tonight, Don. You should buy it for yourself.
He at least could have said, I said a really shitty thing to you. Let me buy that dress for you. Although maybe we would have had complaints about the relationship then, too. Maybe you can't win for losing with us, but...
Yeah. Well, I had said it would have been weird if he bought her shoes.
That's right.
Buying her dress is certainly...
Yeah. Then we wouldn't have approved of that either, I guess.
He really shouldn't have brought up the dress at all.
Probably not.
Yeah.
Also, why did she have to come back to work?
That's an excellent question.
Like, dude, could you maybe cover whatever it is, whatever folder she's going to grab for you?
Yeah.
Could you maybe just let her go have her date? And...
I mean, I guess because Ainsley's still working. She's working on notes for him. I don't totally understand because they know it's going to be passed. They know what they're going to do with it. I guess he has to make his recommendation to the president after having the meeting with Congressman Skinner. But here's another funny thing that stretches the believability a little bit for the sake of educating the audience. We have a funny kind of teledonna between Ainsley and Josh when he goes up to her and says,
talk to me about the full faith and credit clause.
Josh is a guy who went to law school. He writes laws. I mean, I know about full faith and credit, and I didn't go to law school. And,
right. And he might as well just say, explain this to the audience.
Exactly.
I need you for a second.
Yeah. It's funny because he's so much of a legal scholar that he name checks Lawrence Tribe in the episode. He knows Lawrence Tribe. And I mean, of course, you know, he went to law school, but he doesn't know full faith. He needs
a fresher upper on that.
Yeah,
one.
Exactly. I was thinking that Lawrence Tribe, Lionel Tribby.
You know, I think that flicked through my mind as well.
And I would have thought that, okay, Lionel Tribby must be named after Lawrence Tribe, except for the fact that he is name checked so deliberately here. And we already had Roger Tribby.
That's true.
Well before. More trouble with Tribbies.
odd.
I really wanted him to be named after Lawrence Tribe, but I don't think that's the case.
Well, maybe we'll shoot Aaron an email.
So one of the plots in this episode is that Sam isn't writing well. And this felt like something's right out of Aaron's life. I remember when he talked to us for our episode with him, he said, in television, you have to write even when you're not writing well. And then you have to put it on the table for the cast. You've got to give them this thing that you know isn't as good as they are. And then you have to point a camera at it and show it to everybody else. And that felt like he's must just be writing his life here when Sam says,
I'm not writing well. I'd rather not distribute this to the pool yet.
Yeah, I'm looking at my notes and I wrote down, this is the kind of thing Aaron says, because I've heard him say it before.
Yeah. I
never say I'm not acting well. I'm always like, that was pretty good, I think. And maybe that's why I haven't pushed myself to the heights of acting that Aaron has with writing.
Maybe you need to take some more long plane rides at night.
Perhaps so.
Push yourself to the heights of
the Mile High Club. Nope. Left turn. Sorry.
I was going to say the troposphere. Troposphere?
Go ahead.
Stratosphere?
That sounds like a thing.
Is that a thing?
Hey, Ainsley, tell me about the troposphere.
Yeah, the troposphere.
There you go.
It's the lowest layer of the Earth's atmosphere.
Oh, nice.
I think I was right. Okay. You know what's impressive about an episode that mostly takes place on Air Force One is that they still managed to do a walk and talk.
Yeah, they do.
On a plane. They even talk about it.
Right. Toby wants to get Sam out there moving. Let's walk.
Let's take a walk.
Where?
Up and down the plane. Get the blood flowing.
I think the thing that Toby says about the club sandwich.
I'll have a club sandwich, Jack Daniels and ice.
Just Seymour?
Nothing for me.
You have to have something.
I'm fine.
Bring him a club sandwich.
That's like one of the sweetest, like, big brother kind of moments.
See, maybe it's only because I'm a glutton, but my take was Toby just wants a second sandwich. He's not hungry, so I'm going to order another of what I like.
I liked it.
Well, you took it probably the way it was intended. To me, I was like, good move, second sandwich.
There was another thing about Fresca I wanted to mention. It's funny that Ainsley wants Fresca and they don't have any Fresca in the White House, because did you know that LBJ loved Fresca?
No.
He loved Fresca so much that he had a Fresca soda fountain installed in his private lounge by the Oval Office.
How do you know that? How'd you find your way to that piece of marginalia?
I think it was because I was recently watching that movie.
That movie, LBJ Drinks a Fresca. Oh, yeah, well, that would.
I was watching that movie, Elvis and Nixon.
Sure. Michael Shannon and Kevin Spacey.
Yeah. And there's some discussion about President Nixon and how much he loves Dr. Pepper. And I think I was Googling after that to see if that was true or something. And I think I found that, you know.
Interesting.
Different presidential favorite things. I'm not sure I remember. It's been a little while. I've been carrying that around for a little bit, waiting for the Ainsley episodes so I could drop the Fresca.
Let me ask you this. We've commented a bit on Josh and Donna's relationship in this episode and its slight ickiness. I didn't love everybody prying into Leo's, I know the divorce papers are coming, are you going to drink again? That kind of, I mean, he took it well, so who am I as a viewer to get pissed off on his behalf? But it kind of irked me.
Yeah, even Margaret. I thought this was another example of a nice, you know, workplace as family. You've got Toby as Sam's big brother, and then you have Margaret as the, you know, concerned daughter.
Yeah. I don't know. I just like, leave him alone. He's your boss. Or say it once, lightly or something. And then Donna comes in and she feels comfortable enough to bring it up.
Yeah.
I kept waiting for Leo to go, would you guys all shut the f*** up? I'm an adult man.
I did like his response.
I'm an alcoholic. I don't need a good reason to.
It's a good line.
Yeah. Is it weird that Leo would recommend Donna have a nice Petrus with her meal?
Interesting. I didn't bump on it at the time. But I would say I've known many people with drinking problems and many alcoholics, and some of them enjoy talking about what they used to like and what they would enjoy and can be around people who are drinking. And so I think maybe I can still tell you what tastes good.
Or, right.
You know, there was a time.
Did you hear him talking about his Blue Apron meal?
Tell Dario, the chef, that you work for me and that you want the flash seared escalar with foie gras butter and a fresh juniper berry gravlax on a bed of shaved fennel. You have a nice 87 Petrus with that.
Oh, I know. That was like, I thought culinary tech specs for Rishi.
Exactly. This is what I was talking about when we do the Blue Apron ads, and I'm like, it's right out of that Western
very episode. Funny. You're right.
I think the reason why I like this episode so much is a few different exchanges. One is this one between Skinner and Josh. They're now deep into it. They're in the mess. And the congressman says,
the government has a responsibility to protect the rights of minorities, but it can't impose the minority's values on the majority.
Freedom of choice isn't a minority value just because the majority doesn't agree with a minority's choice.
Fantastic piece of writing, yeah.
It's so compelling and so exciting. And both of these points are like salient and sharp. And just to read them on the page, it's incredibly dry. But somehow in the episode, it works. And that is like a distillation for me of what I love about the show.
Mm-hmm. I would say this is my favorite subplot of this episode because we keep returning to them, even though it's not one continuous scene. We get to see sort of the phases of a conversation between two intelligent people discussing an issue of substance. Not the kind of thing you see on TV very often and not done at this level often. So I like this.
And I like how much respect they treat each other with. Mm-hmm. I think we've seen Josh kind of browbeat people on the other side or even people in his own party. But here they really are having, even though Josh gets to do his like up in arms, how can you be a member of this party? But he's still doing it with a level of respect that's really refreshing. Another exchange that's one of my favorite lines of the whole series, something that I think about regularly, you know, maybe once a month, this comes through my head, and it has been actually a huge part of my own life, is this exchange when Charlie writes down, send them to college. He says,
Mr. President, if this was an idea, somebody would have had it already.
I find fault with that formula.
On a totally, like, just aside from West Wing and West Wing Weekly, that was something that was really meaningful to me when I was working on the idea for Song Exploder. I was like, should I do this podcast? I had this exact same thought with myself. I was like, if this was a real thing and this could work, somebody would have already done it. And then I immediately thought of President Bartlett saying, I find fault with that formula.
That's very good. I go through the same. I don't attribute it to the West Wing, although I will henceforth. But I do go through the same thought process, usually in less exalted circumstances, when I'm thinking of like TV shows to pitch.
That's one of those things that's great about the shows, is this little, like a little couplet of dialogue can become, at least for me, a life lesson that I've held on to.
All right, you're doing it. I think you might be the wind beneath my wings. Have I ever told you that you're my hero? No, at the time, this is when I think I felt I had West Wing fatigue. Rather, you know, at that moment, I was like, really? Charlie's coming up with the idea that's now the germ of a new educational policy. And I think I just wasn't in the right frame of mind to appreciate. You got to be ready for it. This goes back to self-worth. Mm-hmm. Charlie is essentially saying, well, I can't generate an original idea that's of worth that hasn't been touched on by somebody else.
And this has been something that's run through the whole series. You know, there's the moment in What Kind of Day Has It Been when he wants to suggest something and Zoe says, you should tell the president. And he's like,
Zoe, I work in a building with the smartest people in the world.
You know, and he gets excited. He gets that feeling of like this feeling, it doesn't go away. But it's still this like reluctance of like, I'm not the guy to have the ideas. I'm not the idea guy.
Okay. No, you've gotten me. I'm appreciating the episode more and more. Just tell me the next time it happens, they say, why don't we ask Charlie? He's always right. Tell me there won't be another time when Charlie's not quite sure whether or not to share his brilliant idea.
Except the funny thing is it was an idea and it was called Teach for America.
True.
The parts where the West Wing decides to depart from reality and cleave to reality is sometimes a little bit convenient because Teach for America is definitely a thing and it had been a thing for a long time by that point.
Well, in our alternate world, it can be Charlie's idea.
But an alternate world where we still have Lawrence Tribe, but no DOMA.
Well, that is true. And I mean, it's the theory of multiple parallel universes, Rishi. Don't get me started.
Okay.
Because I know a lot more than that phrase.
The grand unified theory.
Exactly. Thank you. That's what I was really trying to think of.
The grand unified theory of our multiverses. David Graff is in this episode, and he plays Colonel Chase.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting about that is that he was in an episode of Sports Night, the second episode of Sports Night ever, called The Apology.
The Apology. I remember that.
His character's name in that episode? Chase.
How about that?
That's just, you know.
I think this speaks to Aaron's complex sponge-like mind and his horrific scheduling of writing two series at once.
Right. Like, that seems...
I think stuff
like
gets mixed up in his brain and just comes out, and then you can make weird connections that he didn't know he was making.
Right, exactly. I don't think that there's certainly no reason why these two characters need to have the same name. And yet, he's, you know, I'm sure it's no accident that David Graff is cast for these two different parts. And somehow, when Aaron's picturing it, he associates the name Chase with that actor.
And while we're on David Graff, what's his super famous role? Most recognizable, isn't there?
Police Academy.
Police Academy, thank you. That's what I wanted to say.
Yeah, David Graff, who's Tackleberry.
You know, it speaks to his skill as an actor that we buy him in uniform after playing Tackleberry. Right. We buy him credibly as a man in uniform on the West Wing.
Here's a language nitpick that I thought you would appreciate, or maybe I'm totally wrong about it. But at one point, the president, when talking about this Marriage Recognition Act, he says,
"We shouldn't be defining love, and we certainly shouldn't be ill-defining it."
Which seems like curious, and by that I mean a nice way of putting a totally incorrect usage, right? Like, that's not...
Yeah, no, I definitely bumped on it when I heard it. I didn't write anything down, but yeah.
We shouldn't be ill-defining it.
Yeah, no, that doesn't track.
Yeah.
Particularly.
Also, and here's where your humbugging just can't... must wither.
Yes.
When CJ asks the president about going to Notre Dame, we actually know the reason why the president went to Notre Dame. It's because Martin Sheen made the request to Aaron Sorkin. He wanted him to be Catholic, and he wanted him to go to Notre Dame. But then there's this beautiful other backstory that's created for this episode when CJ asks the president,
"You were accepted at Harvard, Yale, and Williams. Why did you go to Notre Dame?"
"Because I was thinking about becoming a priest."
"Really?"
"Yeah."
"What happened?"
"I met Abby."
Eh, that's so good.
I got horny. I guess.
Oh.
That swept you off your feet?
It did.
Yeah, that was sweet.
That's sweet that his path in life was changed by this one particular woman.
Yeah, I suppose.
Nothing?
I'll give you an I suppose. Okay. Yeah, no, it's sweet. I didn't, it didn't have a huge impact on me.
I love
that. Good background information.
I like that that's how kind of unceremoniously that information comes up. Mm. It's not used as a plot. You know, CJ says, "Why don't you give me something like that when we're running for something?" And he says, "Eh, just to annoy you." And I'm so happy that it comes up in this kind of very humble way, as opposed to having it come out on the campaign trail.
Right,
or something
true.
Like that.
Yeah, that's true.
I guess because, you know, we've known this thing about him and Notre Dame for over a season, the idea that you could still layer in this really meaningful, significant character plot point in his backstory in this exchange is...
Okay. It's beautiful. I love it.
All right, good. Me too. I agree.
Why doesn't she sing the song?
Oh, you wanted the song.
Well, I mean, it's like the Chekhov thing. You introduce a gun in Act One, it's got to go off by Act Two. Don't talk to me about five verses of the Notre Dame fight song and then not have it sung.
Why didn't you sing any Gilbert and Sullivan for me in our last episode?
I don't, it's got to get the analogy.
I'm just saying, sometimes you want a song, you don't always get it.
Well, that is the hard truth.
And now we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Congressman Brendan Boyle of Pennsylvania and Secretary of the Army Eric Fanning. And now back to the show. We're joined now by Congressman Brendan Boyle, who represents Pennsylvania's 13th Congressional District.
Democrat Brendan Boyle.
I guess that's an important detail.
Yeah.
We thought it would be great to talk to you about this part of the episode where Charlie scribbles, send them to college. And one, I was like, oh, that's Teach for America at a federal level. But you have experience in this area before you even got to Congress, right?
Yeah. My experience in it really started from my own experience trying to go to college. I'm the first in my family to go to college. I was fortunate in that I was good in school. It always came easier to me. But then, you know, being able to afford the schools that I got into, especially when, you know, your parents make $40,000, $50,000 a year, is incredibly difficult. And so I have that typical story of piecing together scholarships and student loans and all sorts of odd work study jobs and a dad's union scholarship and making all of that happen. So out of my own experience came a desire to make higher education more affordable. Unfortunately, the last 20 years has only gotten considerably worse. So as a result of that, when I was in grad school, I studied a program that was started in Georgia called the Hope Scholarship. And the idea was kind of similar to send them to college, free college tuition and room and board based on merit. And now different states have different systems. Georgia started it with a 3.0 GPA. That's how they instituted their state lottery. All the funds went to the Hope Scholarship. Florida started it the next year. And I tried to do that in Pennsylvania, but it really came out of, I would not have had the original interest in the subject if not for my own personal experience.
And you are you not married to a public school teacher?
I am, yeah. My wife, she is a passionate public school teacher, used to teach in the D.C. area, now teaches in suburban Philadelphia in the district.
And you're also a huge West Wing nerd, right?
I am a big West Wing nerd. And I watched the show religiously, and recently rewatching this episode was fun for me.
Is there ever stuff that you think about, you know, as a legislator that is inspired by the show?
Well, I'll say this. When we're having a good day in the office, we will joke that, oh, this was like a West Wing day. And then if we're having a bad day, we'll say this is like a House of Cards day.
I wish you no scandal days.
That is true. Thank God we haven't got to that point yet.
Yeah. But
there's always a second term. But I'm really struck by how close the series got to a pretty accurate portrayal. And also, I mean, it's an idealistic version, but it's fairly accurate. And it also reflects that people are complex, that you have the noble aspirations, yet at the same time, the pragmatic, hey, we got to win and got to get reelected. They struggle with that even in the episode of trying to write beautiful prose with the same time of, okay, how do we pay for it? I didn't know, of course, just as a fan, it seemed realistic to me. Now that I'm a member, I'm even more impressed with it and impressed with its realism.
For the program that they want to start, it's 100,000 teachers is the idea, and then it gets knocked down to 100 teachers.
Yeah.
How did you guys pay for the REACH program that you did?
So REACH, kind of similar to how they did it in Georgia and Florida. And by the way, I didn't get this passed in Pennsylvania. So as a Democratic member, I couldn't quite convince the Republican governor of the brilliance of my proposal. So even though a lot of states have the HOPE scholarship or some version of REACH, Pennsylvania to this day still doesn't. It's still either the most expensive or second most expensive public colleges and universities in the country. So I hope that we're kind of halfway through the story and that it's an idea whose time will finally come.
Hopefully there'll be a West Wing ending.
That's right. I'm rooting for the West Wing ending. But in terms of how we funded it, what you see in a lot of these states is it coincided with a time when gaming was being legalized. Mm-hmm. So the question is, what do you use those proceeds for? Do you use it for tax cuts? Or do you use it to invest in education? Now, the irony is, truth be told, actually, while I've no moral problem with gaming at all, I do struggle with the idea that, wait a minute, are we inadvertently creating more victims if 2% of the population is prone to be addicted to gambling by doing this? Are we actually creating more addicts to fund a worthy cause? So I kind of have my own complicated feelings about the funding mechanism. But that said, the fact that it was coming in, it seemed like a good purpose to put those funds toward.
So it wasn't like in this episode where it broke down because of the money.
No,
money was there.
No. I mean, that is, I think, one of the frustrating things to me is that, and it's very similar to the national debate that's happening this year, and the amazing progress that has been made on that issue of higher education affordability is that it's really a question of priority because there are funds there. I mean, we could do it. If you look at what it would cost as a percentage of state budget or federal budget, it's actually, in that perspective, not that much money. It really has been the case, in my opinion, but I think this is proven by the facts. It's a case where it just hasn't been prioritized nearly highly enough.
Yeah, that's a national shame.
Right.
And what it reflects on our priorities.
Right. And it also gets to a deeper question for me. I mean, my dad came here as an immigrant and grew up in a Philly neighborhood where raised to believe in the American dream, flag on every porch. If we believe that America is supposed to be meritocracy, and we're now creating a system in the 21st century in which higher education is more important to get a good job than ever before, and yet we have public colleges and universities that cost more than the average family makes a year, are we really living up to the spirit of the American dream if we're saying that you need education in order to climb that ladder, but here, these rungs right here are impossible for you to attain? So I think it goes to actually a deeper question about who we are as a country and what we value.
And so when you were working for Reach, would you have these kinds of conversations? This is the kind of conversations that are dramatized on the show.
Right.
And would you have these kinds of rock bottom principled conversations, or was it more nuts and bolts practical?
Right. So the nuts and bolts practical was more the 80-90%. And then there's the 10-20% of the time where it's gut check, especially if you get down. Now, Reach, we never got to that point, but other things I've worked on where it gets to the point, okay, you're needing to get some compromise on something in order to get it passed. Where do the compromises happen? And by doing it, are you losing the essence of it? And if you don't do it, are you being an obstructionist and blocking the only chance at a stepping stone? So those kind of conversations tend to dominate. The nice thing, and the reason why I today, as a member of Congress, will hop on Amtrak and play an old West Wing episode, is there are a number of times that I find I need to be re-inspired. You can get worn down. And so it's nice to take a step back and totally escape from whatever major thing you're working on at the time and watch the show that still speaks to you, and it's very inspiring.
That's fantastic. I always wondered what music Michael Phelps is listening to psych himself up. Now I know that there are Congress people with headphones in and they're watching West Wing episodes.
We have a lot of listeners in Pennsylvania, and I'm sure a bunch who are your constituents. Where can they tweet their favorite West Wing quotes at you?
Oh, great. Follow me on Twitter, Rep. Brendan Boyle. If you want to get interesting observations about this presidential election, occasional Philly sports comments, then go ahead and follow me on Twitter, and I have a lot of fun with that. And it's also a great way to stay engaged with the public.
Any other favorite West Wing episodes?
You know, I didn't mention this about the episode. Part of the reason why I love this episode, too, is that I'm a Notre Dame alum.
Oh, that's right.
And I'm a diehard
didn't talk about that. Yeah.
Notre Dame fan. So it spoke to me for many different. And every time, you know, Bartlett would wear an ND shirt or paraphernalia, I would especially love it. So the whole idea that, you know, CJ is being punished.
You approve of his hazing.
I completely approve. And we've done something similar to staffers in my office who make the mistake of publicly not rooting for Notre Dame during football season.
What version of hazing do you do?
Well, you know, that didn't make her sing the fight song, but there is a certain eating of crow, especially if Notre Dame beats the team that you went to school and you're a graduate of that school, it can be a painful experience coming back into the office.
Well, I'm sure Josh approves.
I do.
We're joined now by Secretary Eric Fanning. He is the Secretary of the Army. Before that, he was the Undersecretary of the Air Force. Before that, he was the Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy, making him the only person to have been appointed to three different positions in three different branches of the military.
Thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to. I told Melissa, I'm like, I don't want to come off as a stalker on this because I love the show.
So do we. That's what the whole podcast is about, so.
I mean, just this episode, which I didn't remember that well, there were so many things. You know, Michigan, Notre Dame. I grew up in Michigan. Army plays Notre Dame every year. I mean, there's just a ton from every episode. That's the Defense of Marriage Act, whatever that thing was called.
Yeah, the Marriage Recognition Act in the episode.
Aside from just being a fun show to watch, just how it seems to have predicted the administration I'm a part of now, you know, to have a young congressman beat the maverick Republican and become Secretary of State. My team kind of gets a little tired of it. I'm like, okay, you got to watch that episode then.
What do you think? I mean, I thought the Air Force One thing could be cool, but...
In my previous job, when I was Under Secretary of the Air Force and Acting Secretary of the Air Force, I had responsibility for the plane, and I was on it once, and this colonel's like, it's your plane. I'm like, it's not my plane. But I've never flown on it when it was Air Force One. I've never flown on it with the president. Very involved in buying, you know, it has to be replaced. It's an aging plane. But it's also not an Army thing, so I don't know if...
Also, can you explain for listeners what the Secretary of the Army does?
When people ask, because very few people really understand what a service secretary does, I tell them I'm a CEO of a business unit. I don't really have a responsibility over what the Army does in war. My job is to produce it. So recruit, train, and equip. I got 1.4 million people in or out of uniform, $144 billion or so dollars a year. And I create a product that, you know, I've got to make sure that it's the right product and that it's distributed in the right way, but it gets turned over to the generals and admirals who have warfighting commands. And so they can be Army generals or they can be from the other services.
Because I was so surprised looking over your bio that you were Acting Secretary of the Air Force and then now Secretary of the Army. I didn't know you could cross-pollinate like that.
Well, it's unusual. When I actually started in this administration, I had 9 different titles in this administration. No political appointees ever worked in the Navy, the Air Force, and the Army, let alone also in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. So it just kind of was a nice trajectory, and it's fun to get to know all the services, and nobody's really had that opportunity before.
So that makes you uniquely qualified in some ways.
It makes my experience
unique.
For
this podcast.
Yeah, I don't know exactly. Yeah.
Possibly overqualified.
Well, overqualified because I have seen every single episode of The West Wing at least once. That makes me qualified. It makes my path unique. I like to think it makes me qualified also, but it's a great job. I love it.
And in your current position, you're the highest civilian official in the Department of Defense.
The highest official in the Army. And that's what confuses a lot of people. A lot of times they'll say that you're the highest civilian in the Department of the Army. I'm like, no, I'm the highest official. The Chief of Staff of the Army actually has 2 hats, but in his capacity as Chief of Staff of the Army, he works for me. As a member of the Joint Chiefs, that's a whole different chain that goes up through the Secretary of Defense to the President. So he's sort of dual-hatted, but in the context of the Department of the Army, in terms of building the Army, the Secretary of the Army is the highest official.
I was thinking maybe the president would be the highest civilian, but actually he's not a civilian. He's the commander-in-chief.
He is the commander-in-chief, and he's the boss of all of us. but, you know, my reporting chain, my boss is the Secretary of Defense. Mm-hmm.
So have you've seen this episode before, clearly.
I have, yeah.
Is there anything in it that felt pertinent to your day-to-day life?
Well, the first thing is, of course, the humorous thread of the Michigan-Notre Dame game, and I grew up in Michigan. And, you know, I know that they didn't actually play the year that episode was filmed. And Michigan has won more games in that rivalry than Notre Dame.
Throwing down. We were just talking to Congressman Boyle, who's a Notre Dame alum.
I was rewatching the episode this morning. I'm like, oh, there's 10 things I could talk about in there. But that's certainly one of them, being a big Wolverine. So,
did you get a little incensed at the fact that Michigan really took the brunt of it?
No, because Leo immediately gives it to the president as he's getting on the plane. So there are some Michigan defenders there.
Yeah. So from having been on the plane, how good's the West Wing version of Air Force One?
Very good, actually. It's funny. I'm a terrible person to watch any Washington show with because I can be very critical. Like, that's not the right rank, or that's not that many stars, or that's not what that room looks like. I mean, I think you all know that there are parts of the West Wing that are very accurate physically, and other parts, like where most of the offices were, that don't look anything like the West Wing or the White House at all. By and large, the Air Force One is very accurate to what the plane is like. It's probably a little bit brighter in terms of the lighting in the actual Air Force One because it's not being filmed. But it's a pretty good portrayal. The press compartment is a little bit smaller, and that usually surprises people. But most of the compartments, the way they're designed on the set, are very much like it is on the plane.
Okay, so here's the kind of question that I have that I feel like I never get a chance to ask, but maybe you might actually be able to answer it. There's a lot of discussion about the food on the plane. You know, the club sandwich and the pasta salad. Do they really have like that extensive of a menu on Air Force One?
The military prides itself on hospitality, and it's kind of roughly divided. The Air Force has the planes, the Marines have the helicopters, Army does a lot of the ground transportation and communication, Navy does, you know, the messes and what have you. But when you fly on a military plane, Air Force One is a military plane, the food selections are sort of endless. When I go on a trip as Secretary of the Army, that's kind of one of the things that's prepared in advance. If you're not careful, you're eating way too much food when you're on one of those planes.
And when you had to get the new Air Force One ready, was that part of the, like, did you have to think about stuff like that?
No, you're really thinking about protection and communication mostly. And it's also, you know, the current Air Force One is an incredibly old plane. It's a 747-200, and I don't think there are any more commercial variants of that flying around. There are a couple of cargo planes, maybe.
How old do you think it is?
Well, it was, you know, it was delivered either at the very end of the Bush administration or as Clinton came in, meaning that it was purchased and configured well before that. I mean, we're talking about buying the last 747s, they're 800s-800s that are coming off the line at Boeing, and it'll be a while before they're delivered because of all the things you need to do to the plane to make it safe for the president.
Wow. What else did you?
Well, it was fun. You know, it was no offense to anybody, but I always watch the CJ moments in those things now, and I watch them fast forward to those. So that was fun. But, you know, Josh staying back and working with the congressman on, I forget what the act was called, but a defensive marriage-like act, because that's obviously been a big part of my own experience in Washington, being now the most senior openly gay official ever in the Pentagon, and all the things that we've done in this administration in terms of repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and opening service to so many different other people that weren't allowed before. So it was interesting to watch that now 16 years later, because the Don't Ask, Don't Tell thing seems like ancient history in the mm-hmm. Pentagon. So that Defense of Marriage Act, which, by the way, wasn't overturned by the courts until we'd already repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So, but it seems so long ago now. So to have watched it on that show was interesting. And those were all the real issues that were discussed in Washington when that act was being debated. But it just, it made it seem very dated.
I find it heartening in a way that often we watch an episode of The West Wing and the issues are still burning and completely unresolved. And sometimes the progress has been glacial, if it exists at all. And it's somewhat heartening to say, oh boy, that was way back then. Look how much progress has been made.
I think if I were to divide it, a lot of the social issues have been amazing progress and just how fast things have changed. And certainly in the military, but I think in society in general. But then politically, how much things haven't changed. And one of the, as I said, I use teachable moments out of West Wings all the time. But one of the sort of more maybe meta lessons, there's an episode where Toby is trying to find a compromise on Social Security, and he's working it directly with the president. Josh doesn't know about it, but he figures out something's going on, is sniffing around, and he finally figures out what's happening, and he says to Toby, we don't compromise. We demagogue, and then we win in the next election, increase our power base, and then do it the way we want to do it. And I just see that election after election after election in Washington, that everybody's talking about, we got to get to the next election. You know, we got to win, we got to change the dynamic, and then we got to do it our way. But there's always another election.
Right. You can endlessly position yourself.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of issues in the Department of Defense in terms of budgets and size of the military and so forth. I mean, says we just got to get through this election and we'll get some more guidance on what's going on. I'm like, well, there's another election. The day after this one's over, they'll be gearing up for the next one. So
there seems to be some need to divide politics from the Department of Defense and from the service. But your job is Senate confirmable.
Right.
What is the confirmation process like for a position such as yours?
I worked in the Bill Clinton transition and the Obama transition and was in the first 4 years of the administration in positions that weren't confirmed. And when I was nominated for the Air Force job, one of the people who'd hired me out of college, who'd been confirmed three times in the Clinton administration, in fact, to two of the jobs that I ended up having in, he was my model when I went into mm-hmm. this administration, and I ended up having two of the jobs he had. He said, you think you know the confirmation process because you've been Sherpa for so many people going through it. He says, you'll never understand it until you go through it yourself. And he was right. There are so many more steps to it than I realized. And then when going through the second time, you realize it's different for every person and it's different every time. It actually took me a lot more attention on this second one because it was a more senior position. And I had a member of Congress, a senator, keep a hold on me for a long time. It had nothing to do with me. It was an issue that wasn't even necessarily an Army issue. And so people thought, oh, this dragged on. It took you so long. I was the acting secretary of the Army, and the Senate Republicans made me step down from that before they'd let me have a confirmation hearing. And then the hold hit. And so I was out of that position back in the Secretary of Defense's office for about 4 months. And everyone says, oh, you had 4 months off or a 4 month break. But it's not. It's a day, then another day, then another day, because you don't know.
Oh, you never know.
And when I got confirmed, it was like a Tuesday. And I'd spent that morning working the phones as I was every single day. And what I was being told is, this is going to take a little bit longer we thought. It was, I'm not getting good news. And I was out running an errand that day just to get myself out of the house and try and distract myself and manage my expectations back down to this process is going to have to take a little while longer. When the phone lights up and it's the Army team saying, Senator Roberts, who had the hold on me, wants to talk to you, and it's going to be a good call. And I'm sitting in my car, like not having pulled out of the alley behind the house. I'm like, I got to run this errand. I'll never get this done. And he calls within 2 minutes and he says, Senator McCain, Chairman McCain and I are going to the floor in 2 hours. And in 2 hours, I was confirmed by the Senate, having thought that day that it was going to take weeks.
Right.
And you're there the next day, you know, arm, hand in the air, taking the oath. So it's a... You wake up every day wondering if the Senate's in session, is it going to break today? Is it going to happen today or is it not? And when it does, it happens very quickly.
Sounds nerve-wracking.
You really do every day have to kind of manage your expectations and find ways to calm yourself down.
There's a thread that kind of runs through The West Wing, especially these first two seasons, and even just in a very recent episode, of how President Bartlet has no military experience. And he kind of runs up against that in his own estimation of himself and how he might want to approach military action and with military leaders. And in your job, is that ever a dynamic that you have to walk between your experience as a civilian versus, you know, when you have to, I'm sure there are times when you have to tell generals what it is they can expect, you know, like you're responsible for them.
Yes, all the time. Far more than, it's probably the biggest question that I get. It's a far bigger issue if even being gay is an issue, and it really is not in my experience, but not having served in the military. And my first answer to people is, well, I wasn't allowed to. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a prohibition against that while I was doing all these civilian jobs. And I come from a military family. I have two uncles that were West Point grads and career Army. But I like getting the question because we're 40 plus years into an all-volunteer force, and the military is a very well-trained for what it does. The military, the all-volunteer force is incredibly professional and an important strength of our nation. But that outside perspective is very important, bringing those civilians in. And if you've got the right people in place, we have career civil servants who know the military. We've got the uniformed military, obviously, who knows the military. And then you can bring in some very interesting outside perspectives and experiences to add to something beyond what those individuals may have as an institution because they've all grown up together.
So lack of military experience should not be considered precluding of being able to have an opinion about
because you're making a number of decisions. I'm not going to make a decision about how to conduct a war, but you want that civilian leadership. It's a hallmark of our nation to decide if we should go to war and why and what it means and what you're trying to accomplish. And then when it works as it should and often does, you know, you let the admirals determine how to conduct that. You know, you set the strategic objective and they decide how to get there.
Awesome. So you have no problem backing up President Bartlett in those situations?
None at all, no. Obviously, Nobel Prize winning economist who taught at Dartmouth College. So.
He generally seems to have an emotional response to potential military maneuvers, and then he gets a little bit talked down or hang on.
Goes from emotional to strategic.
That's right.
I mean, along those lines from this episode, the Portland episode, when Josh is telling Toby, when the president gets himself out there, he wants you to be the one that dials him back so he doesn't have to do it.
Yeah, that's right. Understanding your guy.
What's the hardest part of your job?
Well, the hardest, which thankfully doesn't happen very often, is when we lose a soldier. And we'll typically, during the surge, it was happening at really sort of frightening rates, but it doesn't, I think twice since I've been secretary, that's happened. You go to Dover, where the remains come back and the family is there and you meet with the family. That's clearly the hardest part. On a day-to-day basis, it's also personnel. There's 1.4 million people in the Army in uniform or in the civil service. And I spend a chunk of my day determining on the hard cases, you know, is someone going to be made to leave or someone going to be demoted or someone going to lose a rank or something like that. And so trying to sort of sort through those, which are all in gray zones. If they were black and white, they wouldn't make it to me. You know, is this person going to be punished for this? How is this person going to be punished for that? You're making decisions that impact someone's life and some family. And that's definitely the hardest. The politics is, you know, can be challenging at times too, definitely. But that's a part of the job. Most of us have grown up with that. And so it's something that we're used to.
When did you get started down this path?
Right out of school. My first job out of college was on the House Armed Services Committee. And I was working for the chairman, who at the time was Les Aspin, who became Bill Clinton's first Secretary of Defense. So I think I was about 24 years old, moved over to the Pentagon to work with him when he became Secretary of Defense, and was in the Clinton Pentagon for a while and then came back to the Pentagon in this administration.
So pre-West Wing.
Pre-West Wing, yeah.
What did you start?
I think pre-everything. I remember the first cell phone I had the size of a brick. You know, that was...
Do you remember when you started watching The West Wing?
I think it was very early on, but I don't remember when I first watched it. I just remember I've watched it a number of times since.
Thank you for taking the time to join
us. Yeah, no, this is great. This is allows me to be a little bit of a fan stalker and do it in like an official capacity for a real reason.
Exactly.
So, awesome. Thank you.
And that's it for this episode of our show.
Thanks so much for joining us, and we hope you'll join us next time. In the meantime, you can leave a comment for us and discuss this episode with us or the other West Wing Weekly listeners by going to thewestwingweekly.com or our Facebook page, facebook.com/thewestwingweekly. You can also follow us on Twitter. Josh is at Josh Molina. I'm at Rishi Hirway. Our podcast is at West Wing Weekly. Our guests today are on Twitter as well. Secretary of the Army Eric Fanning is at SecArmy. Congressman Brendan Boyle is at Rep Boyle.
By the way, Rishi, you had a tremendously effective, if somewhat pathetic, plea to our audience to like the episodes on our website.
I didn't make the plea.
You didn't?
No, you made the plea. You said to do it,
oh, I did
for
on your
my
behalf?
Sake.
Yeah. Wow, that's maybe that's the pathetic part I was thinking of. but hundreds have liked the Emily Proctor, and I'm now convinced of the efficacy of your, or my plea on your behalf. So maybe you can ask people on my behalf to actually follow us on Twitter, because that's what, I'd really like to see that happen.
That would be pretty great. Please follow Josh on Twitter.
That's what I'm looking for.
He currently has a meager 205,000 Twitter followers.
It's not enough. And also, if you enjoy the show, and admit it, you do enjoy the show, just say it. You could throw us a 5-star rating and a nice comment on iTunes.
That's true. And if everybody who listens to this podcast followed us on Twitter, or if you aren't on Twitter, go and start an account and then follow us on Twitter, we would probably be the most popular podcast on Twitter.
That's true. What else? Thank you for buying pins. Go buy more pins at westwingweekly.com/pin. It's too late to buy a shirt, but thank you if you did. Maybe it'll come back, right?
Or something new.
Perhaps. Or something new.
Maybe a sweatshirt.
Maybe we'll finally put up a donate button for those weird few people that just want to give us money and don't want anything in return. I love those people. The best of all.
Even if you don't understand them. The West Wing Weekly is a proud member of the Radiotopia Podcast Network from PRX, made possible by the Knight Foundation and MailChimp, celebrating creativity, chaos, and teamwork. Check out all the shows at radiotopia.fm.
Okay.
Okay.
What's next?
If you're looking for another podcast to listen to, check out Normal Gossip from Radiotopia. They're coming back for their 6th season. If you don't already know the show, they were named one of the best podcasts of the year by Time Magazine and Vulture, and their new season starts April 17th. Normal Gossip is really fun. It's a show about petty and ridiculous and strange stories and the way that we share those stories. The stories that they tell in the podcast are sent in by listeners, and then they're anonymized and then retold to a guest, and then they have to weigh in on the decisions that the people in the story are making. It's very funny and very beloved. So if you aren't already listening, check out the new season, which starts April 17th. You can listen to Normal Gossip wherever you get your podcasts.
Radiotopia.